Okay, hello and welcome to episode number 120 of the Three Drinks In podcast. I am your host, Vince. Over there is Phil.
Hey.
There over there is Phil, as I said. In this episode, we are doing another Shaken Not Stirred, talking about the movie Diamonds Are Forever. But before we do all of that, I want to remind you that we are available on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radios. Just search for Three Drinks In Podcast. You'll easily find us. Click subscribe, tell your friends, leave a review. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Three Drinks In Pod. That's at the number 3 Drinks In Pod. Like us on Facebook and email us at threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. Anything else I should add here? It's been a while, so I figured we should. Yeah, but no. Okay, here we go. Just today.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I watched it like a couple days ago.
Wow.
So this is the last Connery until we get to like Never Say Never Again, right?
Yeah, this is the last one he did.
Yeah. They paid him to come back an astonishing $1.25 million.
Yeah.
So...
that's what they spent on craft services for the Avengers.
That's not a joke. I'm sure you're lowballing them on that one.
They had a lot of people they had to feed.
That's true. Pretty big production. But, yeah, so George Lazenby didn't really work out, unfortunately. It's the last we saw of George. So.
Yeah. I'm not going to miss him.
No, I didn't really care for him. He looked fine. Like, he... physically looked okay in the role, but I don't think he was a very good actor because he wasn't an actor. He said so himself. He's like, I'm just a model. I'm not. Apparently, he had gone a little bit too deep in the 60s at that point. Like he, at the premiere, he had long hair and a beard, and everyone's like, whoa, Hank, no, that's like you're still trying to sell this thing, George. You can't just make the movie and walk away, and. I mean, this is all based on that documentary, Everything or Nothing, that was available on Netflix a while back. I'm not sure if you can see it there now, but it's a great documentary. It covers everything. But, yeah, he got really, everything went right to his head.
Hmm.
And, you know, that's the end of that.
Models.
So, but they went back to... Mr. Connery, who I was kind of showing his age in this movie. I felt like.
Yeah.
Definitely kind of stood out as such.
Mm-hmm.
So, so what'd you think?
Of Diamonds Are Forever?
Diamonds Are Forever.
I think it had like all those things you need in a Bond film, but it was definitely missing like something. Didn't have that spark, you know. It was just okay. I was a little bored in the middle, but yeah, I don't know. What do you think?
I think that's a good way to put it. I'm trying to figure out what that thing is that because you're right. Like there is like one glaring omission, and I can't figure out what it is. It I don't know. No one seemed to be all that interested in being there.
It's, yeah,
especially Connery, even though they paid him a boatload of money.
It was like a distinct lack of enthusiasm. You know, like, well, here we are with another wacky plan.
Yeah.
They definitely had to mop up the last movie quickly where, you know, because I'd forgotten. It's been a while since we did the last one. And I was like, oh, that's right. His wife died at the end of the last one. And then, because I was like, well, what is he doing? He's like running around all these fake sets, like pretending to murder people until he gets to Blofeld. And I was like, oh, yeah, he killed his wife. What was her name? It's not important.
What was her name? Nobody recalls. Tracy, I think.
Tracy, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, well, so my father-in-law, who's a big fan of the novels, reminded me when I told him that I just watched this one, that in the books, You Only Live Twice comes after on Her Majesty's Secret Service, which is still a mouthful of a title. So, you know, he gets married and his wife gets killed by Blofeld, and then he, you know, goes off on some very long and complicated and sort of internally torturous revenge plot in Japan to kill Blofeld. And that's what the plot of You Only Live Twice, the novel, is. And that kind of makes more sense. You know, going through all like the plastic surgery to make himself look Asian, which, taken out of context, just looked ridiculous and unbelievably racially insensitive given our modern context. But it makes for a good plot to have, you know, your wife gets killed by some criminal mastermind and you spend, you know, a lot of time and energy faking your own death and giving yourself plastic surgery just so you can hunt him down and kill him. Let's watch that movie. That seems like a good movie. But that's not what they did. They did him out of order. And so all of the revenge energy that went into that story was truncated into the first 5 minutes of this movie.
Yeah.
You know, and like one of the things that disappointed me tremendously was like he gives the Bond, James Bond line in the opening thing before the theme song credits. And that's kind of like an important moment, I feel. And at this point, it had been a thing for these movies that's a line he says. He says it in every movie. And, you know, it got like when Pierce Brosnan took over, they actually pulled all the sound out of the film for a second when he gives the line in the casino. It comes at the end of Casino Royale, very dramatically at the end. And here it's just like, yeah, I'm Bond, James Bond. Like, that's my, like, it doesn't really matter. I'm going to kill you now. Yeah. So, kind of just suck the air out of the room for a minute. I'm like, oh.
Definitely play with the convention a little. I mean, I don't, our father also read the books too, and he loved them, but I just don't think about them when I watch the movies because they're so different. Like, it's really not the same thing. You know, they take bits and pieces from each book and they stitch them together. And the movies are not psychological analysis of this person. They're just action thrillers, you know, spy romps, mm-hmm. basically. And they're not meant to be. And that's why I think the last one was so jarring. Where, like, not only did he get married to a mobster's daughter, but we're not supposed to see him get, like, super upset that she died and things like that. So they sort of were like, yeah, let's forget we were doing that. So the books really aren't super important to me in terms of like, what are they going? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they could take the cues from them better though. I felt like, I think they had a different way of looking at the relationship between the original properties and the films, and they just kind of, they didn't want to do anything that serious. Whereas now, if this was the first in a series of James Bond movies, they might make that movie the way the book is more laid out. You know, they were clearly inching towards camp. Like, this movie was definitely much campier than most of the previous ones, even some of the silly ones that Connery was in before. But for the most part, this is, you know, you can kind of see them going, oh, well, we're going to get a little bit more goofy and lighthearted as we go through this. Although there were some really weird elements to this movie that we can get to in a bit. But so you see them get more silly and more campy with it, and that's just not the direction we would go in today. So, like, when someone says to me, well, you know, this is done out of order. And I go, oh, gee, wouldn't that be better? Yeah, it's because I'm used to the way they make movies now versus how they made them 40 years ago, 50 years ago.
They weren't trying to make serious films.
No. I don't think they thought that they could, too. Like I don't think they figured that people would go see them. Because there were so many serious movies being made in the 70s that were fine, and some of them were great, but they were really, like, harsh and dystopic and gritty. And, you know, we were going through, a giant national crime wave at the time, so people wanted to go to these movies to be, you know, entertained with some more lighter fare.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you had, you know, the earlier films with Connery became light hearted action, and then the last one with a different guy was really like dreary and serious. And the only way you could get people talking back then was word of mouth. So they'd be like, hey, Connery's in this one. You liked him, right? Hey, it's exciting and it's got action again, right? You'll come see this one, right?
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't an internet where they could just had a loyal group of people who would go no matter what. There was average Joe Sixpack and his 2.5 children. So
yeah. So I have some notes.
Okay.
Did you catch the nudity in the first like 3 minutes of the film?
No.
Yeah. There. Like before the song singing title sequence thing, when he finds that girl on the beach and he says, "I'm Bond, James Bond," and
whips her top off.
Yeah.
Well, you didn't see anything.
No, I did. Version I saw clearly. I mean, like you didn't get like it wasn't like a long topless shot, but it was like that's clearly a whole breast, which you know in a PG movie now you'd never get.
I barely caught it.
It surprised me. I was like, oh, there that is. Like the song. Song was good, I thought. One of the better ones.
Shirley Bassey.
Bassey. Thank you.
Yeah, it was okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it felt a little on the nose.
Yeah, they all kind of are. You know, they have to work the title sequence in, I think, for the most part. Except for, like Skyfall, I think, is the best one. And they use the word Skyfall in the song. Whereas most of the time when they do that, it just seems forced and kind of cheesy. Goldfinger. Like, there's no reason to sing a song about this guy other than he's in this movie.
Yeah.
You know. And, like, the way that they wrote Skyfall, it kind of worked as both a metaphor and, you know, as a lyric. Just, you know. But, like.
Yeah. If you can't do it that way, then don't do it. Like Casino Royale didn't use the name because they were like, there's nothing we can do with this.
Yeah, they just wrote a really good song.
Make up our different song. Yeah.
Yeah, and the one for Spectre, too, was pretty good. There was, can't think of the name of the guy. Sam somebody. Oh, God. It'll come to me later. Like that falsetto-y type guy. He's like a boy soprano. Sam Smith, is it? Is it that simple?
Sam Smith. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
He was good. And they didn't have like the title of the film in this song. At some point, we just gave up on that. Although I do like Goldeneye, that was a good one. All right, so Mr. Kidd and Mr. Wint.
We're diving into that right away.
Yeah.
Oh my!
Is it my?
Oh my!
Is this their only movie?
The bald guy's been in a lot of movies.
As these characters, I could have sworn that they show up in like a later one, but maybe I'm wrong because they die at the end of this movie.
Well, one gets set on fire and the other explodes, so no.
Yeah,
they don't come back.
Yeah, there's no coming back from that, I guess.
Actually, I think the only one that ever comes back is Jaws.
Yeah, okay.
He was in more than one.
Yeah. Oh, and then he falls in love at the end of that one. That was really cheesy.
Yeah.
So these are two pretty blatantly gay men who also happen to be assassins.
Yeah, well, they're his weirdo henchmen.
Even though they don't have much contact with any mob bosses or criminal bosses. Like, they don't talk to Blofeld, do they?
No.
No, they talk to the the mobsters in Vegas?
It's not a well-plotted movie.
No. No. So, like, the basic plot is that Blofeld's dead and someone is stockpiling diamonds and they want Bond to go figure out who it is, and so he has to go impersonate a diamond smuggler to intercept them by meeting up with a different, hotter diamond smuggler in Amsterdam, and then bring the diamonds, follow them as they go to their buyer in... Like, it's a small amount of diamonds, too. Like, they say they're stockpiling them, but it's enough to fit in, like, an urn.
Well, this is, like, the end. They've been stockpiling them, and this is, like, the last big shipment.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's why they're killing all of them as they go up the ladder, because they don't want any witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, yeah, the American girl in Amsterdam is the hot link in the chain where Bond decides he's going to start saving people.
You know, the old up to lady, then we just killed everybody.
Yeah, the old lady can go screw. So they find her in the river.
Yeah, Christ. And then, yeah, he just follows them to the, you know, this ridiculous thing in Las Vegas, and then that guy who played the weirdo recluse shows up and doesn't know what's going on, and the whole thing is just, yeah, I mean, ultimately I didn't really like the movie, but you're right, it's not well plotted, because you can't tell who Kid and Wint are working for, you know, why they do what they do. It's just,
yeah,
they're just weird for the sake of weird, which isn't bad. I kind of like that about them.
Well, it's not, well, which one are we focusing on? We'll just focus on the two guys.
Yeah,
first.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't do that now. It's unbelievably offensive.
Well, is it though? I mean, they're just bizarre. They didn't do anything to suggest that they were, you know, like, it wasn't like.
It's sort of suggested, especially at the end when they try to kill him, that like they're weirdos because they're gay.
Okay, I guess I can't really say, you know, people seem to be able to interpret things however they want. So if they want to be offended by something, they will be. So yeah, you're probably right that this would not go over well.
I mean, it's not that I was offended. It's just that the problem is that their characterization comes from the fact that they're gay.
Yeah.
Because they're not doing anything unusual that any other henchman's ever done. But because that they're so flamboyant and like leering at each other constantly, and like at the very end when Bond's trying to choke the guy and he goes between his legs and he like screams in delight, you're supposed to look at it like, oh, they're weirdo gay guys, like, you know, they're into this. You know, so they blow up. But and that's what's the problem with them. You know,
yeah.
So,
yeah.
If they were just two weird guys, that'd be one thing. Because they do that today. Like, I think of the two twins in Fargo. Like, one wears red, the other wears black, and they don't say anything ever. They just stand there looking menacing.
Yeah, the Kitchen Brothers.
You know? Yeah, it's weird that they would be dressed like that. But beyond that, you know, they're nothing. They're just stand-ins. So
yeah, and I guess, I mean, you can just pull back that aspect of their characters and nothing is harmed by it. They're just, you know, like, there's one line, they hold hands and that's it, right? Oh, and he wears that offensive ladies' perfume.
He wears ladies' perfume, yeah.
Yeah. But otherwise, there's nothing about them that's overtly homosexual. They just, you know, for a lady, that one line, and then they're walking away from that one scene holding hands.
Yeah. Yeah, it's overly creepy.
Yeah, no.
But they are definitely memorable, you know.
And it's sort of, they're kind of the oddballs out in this. It's an odd tonal thing, because the rest of the film is pretty much a straightforward, rompy sort of spy thriller. Not thriller, not the right word, but action movie. And then there are these two guys that show up and kill everybody, you know, politely. And they don't fit into the puzzle. And that's not necessarily bad, but when the rest of the movie is in such a different tone, they really stand out. So
yeah. And so the problem with all the plotting is that in the middle of the movie, it gets really murky as to what the hell is going on. I don't know who those gangsters were working for.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Why were they involved? I don't understand.
I mean, I think because you're in Las Vegas and because he used Las Vegas, Blofeld did, as his like base of operations by taking over that other guy's, Willard White, by taking over his operation because he was a, you know, it's kind of like a, it's supposed to be like Howard Hughes. You know, he's a recluse and no one knows why. And you never find out why, too.
He certainly doesn't act like a recluse when they come rescue him.
No.
Like Christ. Jimmy Dean on steroids.
I mean, that was when I really kind of went, all right. Because, I mean, I watched this movie. I was halfway making dinner as I was watching it. Like, I was home alone. And I just was in the kitchen doing some chopping. And I'm like, I'll keep it on as I go over here. And I'm like, did I cut an onion and start crying and miss a whole chunk of this? Because, like, you know, because, yeah, I didn't know what the mob was doing there. Blofeld's thing was pretty straightforward. The idea of using diamonds as power sources is still strange to me, even though that pops up in, you know, this and, you know, Batman and Robin and all kinds of movies, you know. And but then they find Jimmy Dean at some, you know, desert mansion where he's got two, you know, multiracial female assassin ladies hanging out there for absolutely no reason whatsoever. And then
that scene sucked. Were they on his side or not?
I don't know. He seemed to be aware that they were in his house. And instead of finding him in his bathrobe with tissue boxes on his feet, you know, he's just like, how you doing?
Yeah.
Would you like some breakfast sausage? Like, I didn't know what to do with this guy. It was so bizarre. And then he's all pissed off that, like, what's that?
Was he frozen?
That's what they said. He was, like, on ice or in the deep freeze and, you know.
But he wasn't, right?
No,
like, he was just in the basement or something?
He was in the basement. And he's all pissed off that Blofeld was able to run his entire operation as him with some kind of, you know, overdubbing phone recorder thing, which they didn't bother to explain how it worked. Like, something about, I have the device and I call you and there's something in my throat.
Yeah, it's just a voice modulator.
But then Bond uses it later, so there's nothing implanted in that in his throat. It was just bizarre. Well,
I think the idea is that it goes through the phone. Like, if we turn on a button on this recording program and I start to sound like a robot, the only problem is for us to see it on screen, it had to look like he was doing it the whole time. So,
okay,
I think the idea was just that when you heard it on the other end, it was someone else's voice,
right?
That.
Which I kind of laughed. I was like, "Well, that's not hard to do, but why does he sound like that in the room with Bond?"
Yeah, it's got to take it one step far.
Yeah, just a lack of thought went into that.
This is the problem with the last movie in that, like, it wasn't. They have all these scenes, especially the last one. But they have all these scenes where, like, they're just doing things and no one takes a moment to explain who they are. So, like, I don't know who you are and what they're doing. You know, even with, like, the gangsters show up at his hotel, they throw the girl out the window and then they leave. And Bond's, like, expecting a fight.
Yeah.
And even I was like, yeah, why are they leaving? And then they don't come back ever. So I'm like, I'm like, what are they doing? I don't understand. And, like, no one talks about it. So how are you supposed to know what's going on?
Yeah, it's like that scene in the in Dr. No where, like, they capture them and then drug them and then don't do anything about that. Like, they give them, like, the coffee and the coffee knocks them out. And you're like,
oh, yeah.
Why'd you have to? You're in there, like, evil lair. You can't escape very easily. Why would you have to drug them just to wake them up a little while later and then say, please put this suit on. We're going to have dinner in an hour. Like,
yeah.
There's a lot of scenes like that in these movies where it's just like, you know, this is going to happen and we can't explain why. That scene did contain the best line in the movie, I thought, though.
Which one? I didn't know there was a pool down there.
Yeah, that was pretty good, I thought. That guy, you texted me today. That guy was on Star Trek for an episode. He played a mob boss on an episode of Deep Space Nine.
Apparently, he played a lot of mob bosses. That was like his thing.
Yeah, and
he's good at it.
Yeah, just this old, and he looked pretty much the same in 1971 as he did in 1999.
Yeah,
you know, he's the Max von Sydow of of gangster actors. Yeah. So here was my ultimate problem with this movie. It's that everyone seemed to be very incompetent at everything they did all of the time. Even like the very scary Mr. Kid and Mr. Wint. Like at some point they, like, Blofeld has Bond in the elevator or in the lair, and he kills the one guy, which is the fake Blofeld, and then the real Blofeld is still there. And then Blofeld just tells him to leave and get in the elevator, and he does it, and then he gets gassed, and then the two gay guys drive him to a construction site in the middle of the night, leave him in a pipe, he sleeps through the night, and the installation of a pipeline that he's now inside of, wakes up, and there's a weird contraption moving through the pipe, I guess, which is also a scene from The World Is Not Enough, by the way, where, like, this thing is moving through the pipe, and he takes it and breaks it, so somebody has to come get him out, and then he's fine. Like, I kind of get scenes like, you know, in Goldfinger when he has him strapped to the table and the laser and the whole, like, slow death and how they made fun of that in Austin Powers. But this sort of just, this is not that. This is not, like, slow death, kind of, like, tense moment where we're going to see how does he get out of this one. It's just this thing that happens to him.
Yeah, well, it's not a good way of making stories. So, like, I actually thought he was pretty good, Bond, this time in, like, sleuthing. Like, he would sneak into places and pretend to be someone else. And he would, you know, jump on the elevator, like, the top of it, and, like, rappel into the offices and stuff like that. Like, he did a few things that I thought were pretty clever.
Yeah, Bond as detective is generally pretty interesting because that's kind of what you think his job would be most of the time.
Right. Well, that's what a spy is supposed to be. The problem is they keep putting him in these situations where if you want the story to keep going, he's got to get out of it somehow. So when you put him in a room with the villain halfway through the film, but you can't kill either one of them or the movie would be over. So you have to find some way to delay that. And so if you watch Goldfinger, he spends most of that movie as the prisoner and they kind of just drag him around.
Yeah.
Which is noticeable and stupid. And in this one, it's like, well, how do we get him out of here? We don't kill him, but, like, we have to make it so that he can come back later. Well, we can stick him in a pipeline and you know, the slow death, kind of like, rather than shoot him in the head, like they spoof in Austin Powers, we'll put him in an easily escapable position where no guards will be watching him, you know?
Yeah, it was so lazily done, though. Like, no one bothered to think of anything more creative than that. And there was opportunities there. They had the two guys with the scorpion, and you could have devised all kinds of interesting things where they would leave him in the desert to die, you know, a slow death of, you know, scorpion poisoning, but they didn't. Like, it was just so by the end of it, nobody wanted to shoot him in the head. And it looked really obvious that they were avoiding doing that very simple thing. And that's what made this movie really difficult for me, was that so many points they'd say, take Mr. Bond away, take him here, do this. Like, at some point, you must see how you're doing that will not help you.
Yeah. Well, like, think of the difference between, like, this one and GoldenEye, where he breaks into the headquarters at the end and they capture him. And how do they keep the story going? He explodes the room with his pen. And, like, there's this tense thing where, like, the pen is about to go off any second now. He's counting all the clicks for the detonator and stuff.
Such a great scene.
Yeah, like, well, there has to be some sort of reason to extend the scene that will change things. You know, make up the stakes a little bit. It's the end of the movie. Make it exciting. Whereas in this one, he gets to the control room and it's like, put Mr. Bond in the brig. And they just put him in a room. Like, it's like a closet or something. It's got all this equipment and stuff. Like, that's not a brig. Oil tankers don't have, like, offshore oil rigs don't have brigs in them. And what's the first thing he does? He escapes.
Immediately. But, like, just yeah. by opening the door. Like, I don't think he did anything terribly interesting to escape.
That's flaccid, sloppy writing. And you know what? I'm sure they didn't care. It was like, well, we just need to get to the scene where helicopters start firing at everybody.
We just need to get to the helicopters. And then at that point, he's like in the crane and he's got Blofeld's little submarine and he's just smashing it over and over again, slowly against the side of the building.
Yeah. You could really tell where they started running out of money.
Or just and, ideas.
Well, if you read the trivia, because, you know, they paid Bond. They paid Sean Connery a lot of money. Like a lot of money to come back. And so they had to take a big cut on the special effects, and it's quite noticeable. I mean, the movie ends in like 3 minutes. They go from the oil rig to him sailing on the boat with the girl. Like, you know, the crappy submarine. What happened to Blofeld? I don't know. They didn't say anything.
Well, you know, that
who were all those people? I don't know.
That caviar doesn't just buy itself. That, you know, that costs actual dollars. I love the point when, like, he lets, like, the weather balloon go.
That's the signal.
That's the signal. And he goes, there isn't a low-pressure system around here for miles. I'm like, what, is he a weatherman now? How does he know what that's supposed to mean? Like, it's just, it's such a specific, I mean, it's such a shitty signal that I'm like, why would Felix know that's the signal? Why would he know what a weather balloon is used for? It just, why would there be a weather balloon on an oil rig?
I'm not sure why he was in the movie at all.
He's backup. He's always, whenever he's in America, or has, you know, like, which is twice now. And like, I forget about the fact that I was like, oh, look, they're in, you know, the US of A, which most of the time these films take place in Europe or Asia. But I forgot that, you know, in Goldfinger, they're in Kentucky for like the second, or the last third of the movie. But he's just there to provide assistance in some way, some kind of supporting role.
Mm.
Yeah, this is like, and like, this is the beginning of the Americans as idiots.
Yeah,
I think every cop in the United States in a James Bond movie is Southern. Doesn't matter where you are, I don't think. I just think that they're, because like I think he goes to New York at some point too, right? Like, as like in the Roger Moore ones.
Oh yeah, he goes to Harlem.
Yeah, Harlem, and I don't know. Everyone is just vaguely sort of. I haven't seen that movie in a long time, or even the whole thing, but like all the white cops are always just have like a twang to them. Like there's always something kind of awkwardly American about everybody in America in these movies. So,
Well, I think the lack of a budget there really hurt, you know.
Yeah, they just blew things up at the end, and like there was no rhyme or reason to it. I mean, you're right that it showed that the money went somewhere else, but it was just like the way it was written was just it wasn't written. It was just kind of plotted through, you know, and. Yeah, no, not that good.
No, not that good, which is a shame because it was really like the last one with Connery, and then they couldn't get Blofeld back, not that they ever did anything good with him. You know, they couldn't use Spectre. They didn't really have a Q scene in this one.
No, they didn't. He was in the film. He shows up at the end, at least. Was he in the beginning at all?
No gadgets.
That's true. He had some, but they weren't. There was no sort of exposition gadget scene. There was just like you have these grappling pitong things that that he used, but there was no sort of this is your exploding pen. This is your, you know, sandwich that does something. Yeah, no, that's true. Moneypenny was in it very briefly too, just at the airport there when he was getting or getting on the not a plane, hovercraft.
Yeah, the hovercraft.
We have those. Is that a thing? I guess that's a thing. It looked like a real thing.
We have them, like we have zeppelins. You know, we have them, but
they're ultimately not very useful.
Yeah,
it's not a practical form of transportation. It's just
it's, yeah,
it's we could use it, so we did.
Could you know, what do we have lying around, Jim? Well, we have the hovercraft. Yeah, get it out there. I read
for some variety's sake.
I read on the trivia that the woman who's Moneypenny really didn't like doing it because she's only in it for one scene. So, like, it interrupted her busy schedule of doing nothing, I guess. So, they kind of, like, threw her in there, and she was like, yeah, this is all I'm going to do. So,
huh.
Yeah. And even M was getting kind of old in this one. It's like, sit down. Like, don't let him do any expository dialogue because he's old.
Bernard Lee.
Yeah.
A little long on the tooth. But I mean, at this point, they've been making these since the early 60s, and he was old then.
Yeah. This is what? 71? 71.
71, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
What else? Anything?
No. I mean, it was a very confusing and unmemorable kind of movie.
I mean, for the movie with the space laser made of diamonds, you know, they didn't do a good job showing that.
No, but to be fair, in a later, you know, Bond film with a space laser made of diamonds. They showed you too much of it, and that wasn't much better either. So,
yeah.
Somewhere is that sweet spot of laser made of diamonds in space that we're just gonna nail. It's gonna be great.
The top 50 space laser movies with diamonds in them.
Seriously, but what is it about these movies where they seem to think that this is a power source or a focal point? I mean,
I think it's like an amplifying thing.
Is it though?
What am I, a diamondician? I don't know.
Geologist is the word you're looking for.
Whatever. I like all the pun names too. What was the name of the Undertaker? Mort what?
Oh,
Sleepwell or something?
Yeah, Sleepwells or something like that.
Like every mortician is named Mort. You know? That's the name of the guy in Bob's Burgers, Mort the Mortician.
It's like the
40 years ahead of time here.
It's like the KFC Twitter. Did you ever see that?
Yeah.
They follow 11 people, 2 Spice Girls, and like 9 guys named Herb.
Yeah.
Which is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. This whole. Yeah, it just wasn't very good, and it kind of makes me like looking forward. I go, okay, so what's next? We have to get through like 17 movies with, what's his face, Roger Moore, and we all know based on either we've seen some of them before that the tone of them is going to be very different than these. And then from that you go to Timothy Dalton, where the tone is much more similar to what we have now with Daniel Craig, but it was too soon. Nobody wanted that kind of a James Bond, you know, in the 80s, I guess that was. And so it's like, can I have to sit through? And I want to keep doing this because it's an interesting exercise in looking at, you know, such a long-standing film franchise, but I'm hoping that the Roger Moore ones, the campy stuff, is done better because they were doing it here and it didn't work. It really just kind of seemed awkward and it just plodded along. It didn't really go anywhere. So there was no elegance to the entire process.
Yeah. It's kind of a bummer. Well, it would be nice that, you know, they took a little bit of time to like really put a lot of care into that, you know. I mean, this movie had a huge chunk in the middle when he was like sleuthing around, but then they had action scenes that were kind of dumb, like the car chases took too long, and so like the ending felt really rushed. Yeah. And then they ran out of money anyway. So I was like, I'm glad they rushed this because, you know, the shots of the helicopters flying by and they would superimpose explosions over them to show that they had blown up. And then you have guys like clearly not stuntmen falling over dead, like pretending that the squibs were going off. And it was just like, oh God, this is really tough to watch.
Yeah. I like the stuff in Amsterdam, though. I think that was one of the better parts of the movie, like the elevator fight and, you know, all
yeah,
the stuff.
Yeah, that felt like old Bond.
Yeah, like I thought of the...
He slaps her around at one point.
It's true. I thought of the train scene in from Russia with Love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's the kind of Bond that Connery was, where he was very ruthless. You know, I'll kick this cat if I have to. I don't care.
The hell with that cat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fun fact, speaking of train scenes, I went back and watched a bit of Spectre last week. Mm. And I never really noticed it before. So they had a train fight in that movie, which is kind of an homage to the train fight in From Russia with Love, because you have, you know, a much... bigger guy in what's his name from Jaws, Shaw.
Dave Bautista is the new guy, though.
Right? But I'm thinking of the
Robert Shaw.
Robert Shaw, I can think of his name. So yeah, like Robert Shaw is huge. He's like 6'5", and so is Connery. He's two big guys just beating the snot out of each other in a pretty small space. And so I'm watching this scene in Spectre on the train, and you know, they're in the dining car, everyone's ordering drinks, and next thing you know, he sees Dave Bautista come up from behind him in, like, the little dome of the serving platter. And this ridiculous knockdown, drag-out fight ensues, and everybody vanishes.
Yeah.
I think...
Because they trash the train cars they're in, right?
Right, but, like, I think at one point you see one, maybe two people who were like in the background who are still there, but everyone goes away. And so you sort of don't see like how they get out so quickly. You know, most of them are just literally vanished there. And then those two guys you see like in the background, like out of focus. And so I was like, what, where did everybody go? And then they destroy half the train trying to get, I mean, really a lot. And next thing you know, they're doing it in their cabin and no one seems to care.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't bother me in the moment because, I don't know, I wasn't thinking about it, but that was one of the great things about the train fight in the Sean Connery movie was that, like, it was contained within their cabin. They were trying to kill each other in a very small space so nobody would notice them.
Right.
And then he had to hide the body and, like, you know, try to get by while, like, having this giant dead Scottish guy laying on the floor. And... In Spectre, it was just like, we're going to do this, and then we're going to have sex, because that's what James Bond does after he kills somebody, is have sex. And then they just drop them off at that post in the middle of nowhere, and they wait for that, you know, Rolls Royce to show up and pick them up.
Yeah, it wasn't a good movie either.
Parts of it are kind of glaring at me. They're like, yeah, this really wasn't all that good. Skyfall was better. But anyway, but this movie stunk.
Yeah, it was... It was rote.
Yeah, it's just kind of going through the motions.
Yeah. Like, let's get back to where we were before all that nonsense with the wife and everything.
Yeah, that was they really hamstrung themselves with that one. Mm-hmm. That was not a good idea. I mean, they could have done something cool with it. I mean, and, like, this is before they would really entertain the idea of sort of reimagining something. So, like, they kind of did it with Pierce Brosnan, a little bit, where they didn't give you the idea that this is a new Bond, but they just pointed out the fact that, you know, okay, so there's a new M, like things are different now. It's a different time, but the Bond is still the Bond. Like he's still himself, but the people around him are starting to point out, like, hey, you can't behave like this without people noticing, and we're not all just going to pat you on the back and say this is great, James. Thanks a lot. There are consequences now to this new, you know, the new modern era. Mm-hmm. And that was as far as they went. And then with Craig, they said, okay, this is basically starting from year zero, which we're used to as a viewing public now, because we've kind of comic bookified movies to the point where you can say we're going to, you know, the word reboot is a thing. Whereas that word didn't exist, I don't think, back in 1971.
No, it was a different time.
So, yeah, it wouldn't have occurred to them to say, all right, forget everything you've seen previously, or like lock it away as nostalgia, and we're going to move forward now with an entirely new idea. And that made coming back from things like Your Dead Wife really sort of complicated story-wise.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, that's all I've got to say. What'd you think of the Bond girl? I guess we didn't say.
Oh, Jill St. John?
Yeah.
She was sort of more interesting than most. Not like she began that way at least, and then her character kind of petered out. Again, like they just ran out of steam and apparently money, as you pointed out.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, he meets her in Amsterdam and she's kind of interesting, and she's a bad guy, but not really. She kind of comes around.
I couldn't remember what was she supposed to be?
She was a diamond smuggler alongside the guy he was impersonating, and they were working together to move the diamonds in the shipment from South Africa to up through Amsterdam and then across to Las Vegas. And so she didn't really serve much of a vital role. She didn't really need to be there.
Yeah, because, like, she was American.
Right.
So why, what, I don't know.
Again, she didn't need to be there.
Like, Bond is impersonating the guy who's supposed to get them from Amsterdam all the way to California. And he goes to see her, and she's like, you have to go do this. I'm like, yeah, we knew that already. Why did we stop here to talk to you? I don't know.
My guess is because she looked like Jill St. John.
Yeah, that's a good guess. So. She changed her wig the first, three times in 5 minutes.
Yeah. It's like this. It's like the, the girls in Quantum of Solace, like the one, like the British, agent that goes to pick him up and tries to take him back to England is just this really hot, I think Gemma Arden is her name.
Mm.
And just this really hot girl who he has sex with, and then they cover her in oil, a la Goldfinger. Like, she does nothing in the movie, absolutely nothing.
Well, I mean, there's always like the extra girl.
Yeah, but the extra girl, like they had the extra girl here,
yeah.
In I can't think of her name. I think it's Lana Wood. It's Natalie Wood's sister.
Yeah,
and she doesn't really do anything, but get him. But like, she's just eye candy for 10 minutes as he plays craps in the casino for a bit. I can't think of what he was doing there. But, like, this is a bad example because she was extra, in all kinds of ways. Because then they throw her over the balcony and she does nothing. I don't know.
She gets killed.
Yeah.
Sadly.
But anyway, we can move on from here.
Okay.
So, all right. I think we're going to do a 2018 summer movies recap at some point, so you all should stay tuned for that. Just a reminder that we are available on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio. Just search for Three Drinks In Podcast, and we're there. Click subscribe, tell your friends, leave a review on Twitter and Instagram at Three Drinks In Pod. That's at the number 3 Drinks In Pod. Like us on Facebook and email us threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. Anything else we need to round this one off with?
No, that's it.
All right. As always, please drink responsibly, and we'll talk to you all next time.
Yeah, take care.
Bye.
Diamonds are forever. They are all I need to please me. They can stimulate and tease me. They fear that they might desert me. Diamonds are forever. Hold one up and then caress it. Touch it, stroke it and undress it. I can see every part, nothing hides in the heart to hurt me. I don't need love, for what good will love do me? Diamonds never lie to me, for when love's gone, they last on. Diamonds are forever, sparkling round my little finger.